From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week's Beatles series on TV filled us in on what it was like to be a Beatle. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we find out what it was like to be married to a Beatle. We'll feature a 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon. Also today, Harry Belafonte talks about his music and film career. He stars with John Travolta in the new film White Man's Burden, which opens next week. David Bianculli reviews a miniseries on home video by the late Dennis Potter, who created Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. And on this Black Friday, perhaps the busiest shopping day of the year, a poem about shopping. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Tens of thousands of French civil servants took to the streets today to protest a government austerity plan. The 24-hour strike has paralyzed the country. From Paris, Lynn Terry has more.
There's very little public transport in Paris, and the roads are clogged with cars. But thousands of civil servants still managed to turn up for a demonstration. There are protests in other major cities as well. The workers are angry about the government's welfare reform, which will force civil servants to pay longer into their pensions. The plan will also hit doctors, who will have to pay the government for any wasted services. Many doctors have joined the protests, along with students who want more money for education. The unrest is a key test for the government, which has vowed to cut the budget deficit. It needs to trim public spending in 2 years so that France can join a single European currency. Prime Minister Alain Juppé says if 2 million people take to the streets, his government won't survive. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Citizens of Ireland are deciding today whether to lift the country's over half a century-old ban on divorce. 9 years ago, a similar effort to change the Constitution failed by a nearly 2-to-1 margin, but polls now show the country evenly split on the issue. The government is in favor of lifting the ban for a number of reasons, as NPR's Andy Bowers explains.
The people on the pro-divorce side here are concerned about showing, as they put it, tolerance to minorities within the mainly Catholic Republic of Ireland. They're concerned that if Ireland turns down divorce again, as they did in 1986, that it will send a bad message to Protestants, the largely Protestant section of Northern Ireland, if they were ever to want to join with the Catholic South.
NPR's Andy Bowers in Dublin. Results of the vote are expected by tomorrow. Famed film director Louis Malle has died in Beverly Hills. His best-known movies include Pretty Baby and My Dinner with Andre, a 1981 cinema verite conversation between two actors that Malle made look deceptively simple.
It seemed absurd to make a film like 2 hours about two characters discussing in a restaurant. So the whole point was at the end that it seemed like I've just been shooting them, and when actually we rehearsed for months, I work with them more than I ever worked with actors. I think I've directed Wally and André Grégory more than I've done ever.
Malle was 63 years old. President Clinton has letters from the leaders of Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia promising to ensure the safety and security of NATO troops that will monitor the new Bosnian peace agreement. The letters were obtained by U.S. officials at Mr. Clinton's insistence during the peace talks in Ohio. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7.25 points to close at 50.48.84. This is NPR News. Poland's Supreme Court says it has received over 500,000 protests from voters over the outcome of the recent presidential election in which ex-communist Aleksander Kwaśniewski upset incumbent Lech Wałęsa. Most of the protests call for the election to be annulled because Kwaśniewski had misrepresented his educational qualifications. Nicholas Leeson, the fugitive British futures trader whose massive losses brought down Britain's oldest bank, was formally charged today in Singapore. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Leeson was charged today in court with 11 counts of fraud and forgery, which carry a maximum jail sentence of 14 years. The 29-year-old Leeson is alleged to have manipulated records to conceal the more than $1 billion he lost in trading on future exchanges in Singapore and Japan. Leeson fled Singapore just as news of his massive losses began to emerge. His return to Singapore caps one of the most publicized and police-protected extradition cases in recent memory. The judge presiding over Leeson's case, there are no juries in Singapore, ordered the charges to be read out in court today and then sent Leeson to prison to await his next court appearance December 1st. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
A 3-year-old North Carolina boy is in critical condition today after being attacked by his family's pet Bengal tiger. He was mauled by the year-old tiger while it was being walked on a leash. The boy required over 15 hours of surgery to treat his wounds. The Los Angeles Bar Association is reportedly divided over whether to give its Trial Lawyer of the Year award to O.J. Simpson prosecutors Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden. The Los Angeles Times says the association's trustees have rejected a recommendation that the two get the honor. The group's president says giving them the award would be a slap at the Simpson jury and undermine public confidence in the verdict. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week we've heard a lot about what it was like to be a member of the Beatles. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're going to hear what it was like to be a Beatle wife. We have a 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon. Back in the 60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized about romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Lennon was married to John. They shared a working-class background and met in art school in 1957. They were married in 62. During the years John toured the world, Cynthia was at home raising their son Julian. Cynthia and John divorced in 1968 after John fell in love with Yoko Ono. John Lennon was assassinated 12 years later. Cynthia Lennon told me how she met John.
I met John Lennon at college when I went to junior art school and John went to secondary school. And I passed all my exams and I got into college. And John happened to be there at the same year as I was, but in different classes, because the first 2 years is foundation course and you do different things. And I didn't really come across him until more or less the second year.
Was music an important part of his life then?
Well, he always carried around a battered old guitar over his shoulder, so I guessed it was at the time.
When you decided to get married, did you think you were going to have a pretty ordinary marriage?
Well, actually, we didn't decide to get married because it was a situation where we had to get married. You know, so we were rather irresponsible students at the time, and I became pregnant, and that's when we got married.
Did either of you resent that? Did you feel prepared for it?
Well, we were both totally shocked, and I was extremely ashamed because at the time it was a terrible crime. And it was something that we both were really, truly shocked about, but had to get on with it. And John accepted the responsibility, which was marvellous. I mean, he needn't have done, but he did.
Was he performing with the Beatles yet when you were married?
Yes, yes. We were just beginning to perform with Beatles. It was about the time that Brian Epstein signed them up that we were married, just about the beginning.
When did you realize that something very extraordinary was happening with that group?
Well, they were always extraordinary. Even as youngsters, as students, they were extraordinary. They had charisma about them. They had a great raw energy. And I think it was possibly when they were in Hamburg, when they first went to Hamburg, and they were out of the country, out of their hometown, and they were faced with an audience of ruffians and sailors, and they were working in the Reeper Barn in Hamburg. And they had to cope with different types of audiences, very hard, work very long hours. And that was when the magic started coming out, and that was their apprenticeship.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation because in those days it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked round pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes. And in fact, I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, no, I'm somebody else.
Did John feel at all uncomfortable telling his wife not to act like his wife?
Well, it wasn't a sort of husband-wife situation, really. You know, again, it's very hard to describe because we had a son on the way and we were married very quickly and the Beatles started and the music started and the fame started and the press. And it wasn't a sort of natural, normal husband and wife situation at that time.
When fans did find out who you were, what kind of emotional reaction did they have toward you? Did a lot of the teenage girls really hate you or become jealous of you because you had the person who was the object of their fantasies?
Not at all. Do you know, I was very lucky, really. I think I expected it. I really was a little worried about it. But all I've ever had from the fans has been love and support. And if there was any envy or jealousy or hate, it didn't come across to me.
Did they want to live through you in a voyeuristic way?
In a way, yes. I think the fact that they wanted to wear the same makeup and wear their hair the same way and wear the same clothes, and that was flattering in a way, but it wasn't antagonistic at all.
It's funny, you know, you mentioned your hair, and you've mentioned that John Lennon wanted you to look like Brigitte Bardot, that he was really fixated
yes.
on Brigitte Bardot.
Yes, he was. He had plenty of posters of Brigitte Bardot and Mylène de Mongeau and many, all foreign. And, of course, a Liverpool girl trying to emulate that sort of style was something else. I couldn't change my accent to French, but the one thing that I could do was to grow my hair. And, of course, I started lightening it and it got lighter and lighter. And then he was very fascinated with black stockings and short skirts and, you know, and for me it was difficult at first because I was pretty conservative. They used to call me Miss Powell. You know, they used to think of me as a sort of secretary type with specs on, glasses on. And I always used to be kidded about it, and they'd always say, oh, here comes Miss Powell. And this was before John and I got together. And then, of course, when we did get together, I just... I didn't fall in, but I was influenced by him a lot. You know, of course, I mean, I loved him. So I did as much as I could to please him in that respect. And I pleased myself as well, because I was a little bit fed up with being called Miss Powell.
What was it like in the days when you were a young mother and John was mostly on the road touring and he'd have, I guess, like a couple of weeks here and there in between tours to come home and play the role of husband and father? Was he able to make that transition from rock star and figure of fantasy to young father and husband?
Extremely difficult for him, because even though when he wasn't on the road touring, he was in the recording studio. So we saw very little of him. And when he did come home, he was so exhausted and so tired and so overwhelmed by the pressures of the outside world that when he came home, all he wanted to do was to collapse. When he used to sleep an awful lot. And he would wake up when we were ready to go to bed, if you know what I mean. With a small child, you have to be up early in the morning. And then you're pretty exhausted at night. Whereas John's hours changed. You know, he'd be up at night and in bed during the day. So the whole fabric of our life changed because of the work that he was doing and because of the pressures from outside.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K, and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in, and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. Yeah, I'm not being crude on this, but I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
Did you ever have a desire to have other relationships too, since chances were that he was having other relationships?
Not at all. No, I'm a one-man woman. I always have been. And very difficult, you know, I suppose it sounds not boring, but, you know, in this day and age, there's so much infidelity and all sorts of things going on. But no, I'm a one-man woman, and I believed and loved my man at the time. And there was no way I would have dreamt doing anything like that.
We're listening to a 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon about the years she was married to John Lennon. One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it, but our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner. And after dinner, he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD. And, of course, it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds. And for me, that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture. And I couldn't cope with it, and I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And, of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug, so he tried it again. And then if you realise at a time like that, when there's so much money around and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers, so there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. They were captive audiences to these people who were constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's a division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home. really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. Like, he wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John again was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we're all devastated by Brian's death.
How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start when you saw them together that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt and uncle and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
You still angry about that?
No, I'm not. I'm really not angry. If I could understand it more, it would be easier. But I didn't get a chance to have an explanation for it. I'm not angry about it. I'm really not. It's just, it's in the past. It's finished. It's done.
Were you able to talk with him? Would he make time to talk with you about the divorce proceedings?
Not really. It was all done through lawyers and solicitors.
That must have been very frustrating.
It was very sad. Very sad that you were cut off so quickly. Cut out of somebody's life so quickly. But there's not a lot I can say about that.
I can't imagine what it was like for you, you know, to, after
going from the, you know, fairly conservative childhood to suddenly being in the middle of all the Beatlemania stuff, and then it ends, you know? Then there's a divorce, and you're still kind of identified with it, but it's in a lot of ways out of your life. And you didn't have the money anymore either.
No. Well, I think it's called survival. It's simple as that. I think you have to survive, and you have to keep your feet on the ground and hope for the best and keep on laughing, you know, in life. I'm not laughing now, but I mean, you must carry on. I had a son to look after. I had a child to bring up. And what if I'd fallen by the wayside, what would have happened to him? Very important. Julian was very important to me at that time.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. I mean, because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy, because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always. I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, of just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Cynthia Lennon, recorded in 1985. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear from singer and actor Harry Belafonte. Next week, he opens in the new film White Man's Burden, which also stars John Travolta. Also, David Bianculli reviews a series by the late Dennis Potter, now on home video. Potter is the creator of the miniseries Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. And on what may be the busiest shopping day of the year, a poem called Shopping. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Harry Belafonte stars with John Travolta in a new movie that opens next week called White Man's Burden. It's a story about racism in which the racial balance of power is reversed. Belafonte plays a wealthy industrialist born into a life of privilege. John Travolta plays a factory worker. This is Belafonte's first film role in many years. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1993 interview with Belafonte. In the mid-50s, he popularized Caribbean calypso in the U.S. with hits like Jamaica Farewell and the Banana Boat Song.
Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and a drink a rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman.
After Belafonte's musical success, he started his Hollywood career, starring in such films as Carmen Jones, Buck and the Preacher, Odds Against Tomorrow, and Uptown Saturday Night. In the 60s, Belafonte used his financial resources to back young black artists, and he used his international popularity to strengthen the civil rights movement. He's still an international human rights activist. Belafonte was born in Harlem. His mother was from Jamaica, his father from Martinique. When he was 5, his mother sent him to Jamaica. He told me why.
Well, my mother was my father was constantly away. She was, for all intents and purposes, a single parent. She was a domestic worker, a woman who was struggling to get over as an immigrant in this country. Her children were left to the whims of the neighborhood and to the streets of New York. And at a very early age, I was hit by an automobile.
Oh.
And was unconscious for a couple of days at, in Harlem Hospital. And that sent a horror through my mother. And she felt that I would perhaps be safer in the mountains of Jamaica than I would be in the streets of New York, and sent my brother and myself there.
What did you think of the idea of going to Jamaica?
Well, I didn't mind the idea of going to Jamaica. What really bothered me was the fact that my mother had to leave us there. And once again, there we were thrust into the midst of strangers and people whom we didn't know, and having to make it on our own, so to speak. And plus the fact that we never stayed in one place very long. My brother and I were quite nomadic. We just went from place to place and never really established a sense of community, and never stayed long enough with one family to have ourselves in some centered place.
Were the families that you stayed with part of your extended family, or were they strangers?
Both. Both extended family as well as some strangers.
Why didn't you stay in one place for a long time?
I think it was a matter of economics. I think some people found two additional children to their own families a bit of a burden.
Mm-hmm.
They were poor. So we were constantly shifted from place to place so that others could help share the responsibility. Some places we were just very unhappy in and didn't want to stay, and were sent to other places.
But how did you get back to New York?
Well, the war broke out between England and Germany. My mother was convinced that, like many people were, that the invincible Nazi machine was going to soon conquer England, and what would happen to all of the English possessions, all of their colonies. And she feared for that, and then brought us back home when I was 12. And I've been living in America ever since.
Was it hard to readjust to Harlem?
Very hard. I had an accent from the Caribbean, and I looked different, and I had this dyslexic problem that I couldn't adjust to the schools that I was in. And my mother seemed to have been very much part of that shifting from place to place to place to place. We lived all over the city, within the ghetto in which we were forced to live. And we moved from one neighborhood to another neighborhood. My mother was always chasing work, and chasing places where she thought we would have better accommodations for less money. So we were constantly on the move.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harry Belafonte. So how were you first exposed to theater?
When When I came out of the Second World War, I was kind of looking for where to go and what to do. And in the interim, I became a janitor's assistant in a building. And I repaired the Venetian blinds in the apartment of a young woman by the name of Clarice Taylor, who is known by many people as the mother of Mr. Huxtable on the Bill Cosby show. And she played the good witch in The Wiz. She was the tenant in the apartment, and I repaired the Venetian blinds. She gave me two tickets to a play at a community theater called the American Negro Theater, which was at the Harlem Public Library. And I'd never been to the theater before, and I had this opportunity, so I went. And when the lights went down and the curtain opened and the players walked on, a whole new world opened up for me, and I was deeply touched and moved by it. And that's how I got into theater.
Could you explain what it was that really reached you about the performance?
I saw people of color on a stage articulating a point of view on a subject, and I found it quite magical. I found them doing things that were quite wholesome. I saw the audience respond to the moments that the play took them, either to laughter or to something very dramatic. And I saw people in motion doing things that were very positive and very creative. And I loved the rhythm of the playwright, the way the language flowed, the way people answered and spoke to one another. I became totally involved. As a matter of fact, at the end of the play, I went back to thank her for the ticket. And I had to stand with a long line of people because it was the closing night of the play. And it was a repertory format. And they were getting ready to set up the next play and were taking down the sets. So I pitched in to help take down the sets. And because I was good with my hands. And when I got through doing the work, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Clarice Taylor had left. I never told her thanks for the tickets. But I knew that I wanted to get back to this environment, to these people who were about something, who had a sense of purpose. And I didn't start off wanting to be a performer. I started off just wanting to be involved. And then they came up with a play for the text to begin to dismantle, to find out how to build a set for it. And the play was Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock. And I became exposed to this Irish playwright who was, I thought, one of the most incredible writers that I'd ever read. And I had not read that much up to that point.
So when you started to study acting, how did you work on yourself to kind of transform yourself into an actor, both in terms of the craft, but also in terms of the type of person you thought an actor needed to be?
Well, when we got the play, my job was to work with a group of young men and women to build sets. And they needed someone to play the young male lead in the play, and they didn't have anybody within, either in the school at the American Negro Theater, and those who had auditioned, they found the work was somewhat unacceptable. So they asked me, would I play it? And I just, and in the spirit of teamwork, I accepted being a performer, to perform this part. And when I had to learn the words and then get into the play, then I was deeply touched by the fact that I now had an opportunity to interpret and to articulate the words of this great writer. And I wanted to do more of that, and I wanted to become proficient in the ability to be able to do that. And in order to acquire this proficiency, I had to go to an institution that was committed fully and solely to this, and it was the New School of Social Research. Erwin Piscotta, who ran the school, was a German Jew who had escaped Hitler. He was at the Max Reinhardt Theater in Germany. He introduced us to Bertolt Brecht and to Jean-Paul Sartre, and he brought a richness of literature and culture to the school. Many people sought to be in his class. And among my classmates were Marlon Brando, Walter Matthau, B. Arthur, Rod Steiger, Tony Curtis. There's a bunch of us, all young kids, just starting out, or young men and women, wanting to be in theater. And it was in that environment that I developed this great love and comfortability, really, with the idea of being an actor.
Once you fell in love with theater and then got your theater training and developed into an actor, were you able to find parts?
No, that was the irony of it all. I then had to deal with racial reality. No matter how much I loved this thing, if I didn't play in the American Negro Theater or once every millennium when a black play came along, most of which were musicals, there would be no opportunity, really, on a full-time basis. So I was quite prepared to flirt with the theater and to do as much as I could in it while looking for some work that would give me the opportunity to pay the rent. Before I could even deal with that, I ran out of the federal subsidy that was given to us to be in this school.
And from the GI Bill.
Yeah, GI Bill of Rights. And what happened was that I was a frequent visitor and a devotee of jazz and a frequent visitor to a place called the Royal Roost. And I went there nightly because our school was only two blocks away from the nightclub in the middle of the heart of Broadway. And I'd struck up a friendship with a young man named Monty Kay, and he was the promoter and the impresario for everything that went on in that club. And he'd heard me sing in a school play, only as an exercise for the play. And he then said to me, well, I've heard you sing. Why don't you learn a few songs? Come into the club. I'll make you an intermission singer. And during that time, you'll be able to make enough money to continue to pursue your studies in the school, if the school will then give you a scholarship. And I went to the administrators at the school, and they gave me a scholarship, and I started to sing to pay my way through school. The singing then got so popular, and people responded so strongly to it, that I feared that it would take me away from the theater. And I didn't consider myself a significantly important jazz singer. I didn't find that pop music particularly moved me to the places that I wanted to go after this heavy encounter with Shakespeare and Tolstoy and Chekhov and all the things we were doing as students. So I quit and singing, and I opened up a small restaurant with a couple of other friends with the money that I'd saved called The Sage in Greenwich Village. And while there, studying during the day and working at night, I discovered the Village Vanguard, a nightclub in New York, which was rich with folk artists, and I discovered Lead Belly, and I discovered Big Bill Brunsey, and I discovered Pete Seeger, and I discovered Woody Guthrie. And much to my amazement and delight, I discovered Josh White. I saw these men and women singing songs that came from all walks of life. It wasn't just songs about unrequited love. They were filled with drama, they were filled with characters, they were filled with parables and metaphor. And I saw in that the opportunity to apply my acting skills. And since I had a voice that was fairly comfortable to listeners, that I would then have the instrument to be able to do this. And I began to develop a repertoire. And with that, I then opened at the Village Vanguard. And I just haven't looked back since.
My guest is Harry Belafonte. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with Harry Belafonte. You were really one of the first people from the entertainment world to become active within the civil rights movement. Was there a period that was a turning point or a consciousness-raising period for you?
Yes. When I was born.
Okay.
And it was later on exercised even more when the war came, Second World War, and I got into it. And America propagandized us about ending totalitarianism and ending fascism and ending racial superiority and ending anti-Semitism and making the world perfect for a meaningful future. And I believed that. And then I came back to my home after having done a tour of duty and the war ended. we expected that there was going to be some reward for all that we had done. Just little things like taking down the segregation signs as a gift to those of us who fought to make America safe and to end the world with, end the world its tyranny. And that didn't happen. And the option was to acquiesce and to go back to business as usual, or to use our strength and our energy to make sure that America would never be comfortable in going back to business as usual. And I decided that that's what I would do as an artist and as a human being and as a person. And that was when my activism started.
How did you meet Martin Luther King?
He called me. I was in New York, and he was coming here to visit for the first time in Harlem at Adam Clayton Powell's church, the Abyssinian. And he was talking to a group of people from the clergy. And I asked, would I meet him after that meeting? And I said, yes. And we met in the basement of the church, and we talked.
And you became pretty good friends?
Very good friends. We became very, very close. After I spoke to him in the room and he told me of his mission and what he hoped to be able to achieve, albeit he didn't know quite where the path would lead us, but he knew that it was a fight that had to be made and he needed everyone he could get, and asked me if I would join, I said, yes, I would.
Do you think your voice has changed much over the years?
My voice has changed a lot over the years. I never had any formal vocal training. And as the state of the art developed and electronic music became more demanding and commanding, the voice gets heavier. I think it matures or gets older. And I find my singing style different because I get more energy and I get more drama behind things that I want to do by hitting notes and hitting lyrics a certain way that I wouldn't have done in an earlier approach where I was far more lyrical and far more, you know, had a tone that was far more refined than the ones I choose to use now. I could get back to that sound if I wanted to, but I don't see any particular virtue in that.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain raspiness to your speaking voice. Does that come through in your singing voice too now?
No, because I engage different muscles. When I sing, my diaphragm kicks in more fully and I project more fully. I'm prone to talk softly. And air escapes because of a tilted larynx, which I have, which permits air to come out in a free-flow, uncontrolled way that I would not ordinarily have were my larynx straight. But it was an act of birth. And as a matter of fact, the print of my voice I like very much. It's like Louis Armstrong or mm-hmm. others who have a voice that's just very different from everyone else's. And what it forced me to do was to interpret material in a way that would accommodate this impediment or this imperfection, and therefore gave me a very unique approach to my singing that people liked, and I loved it. And I took great confidence in the fact that one did not need, I think if you've got it, you should sound like a Pavarotti or sound like a Leontine Price or whatever. But when I heard people like Walter Houston sing, who had mm-hmm. a gruffy voice, and mm-hmm. when I listened to other singers, I was confident that I could move comfortably in the world of art and be accepted for what I was.
I want to thank you very much for telling us some of your story. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Harry Belafonte recorded in 1993. He stars with John Travolta in the new movie White Man's Burden, which opens next week. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Potter, the acclaimed British TV writer who died last year, is best known for what he calls his dramas with music, like Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. The more recent example, The 6-Hour Lipstick on Your Collar from 1993, has been released on home video. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The way I see it, there are only a handful of TV drama writers who can be considered the absolute best at what they do or did. From the so-called Golden Age, there's Patty Chayefsky, Rod Serling, and maybe Reginald Rose. From our current generation, there's David E. Kelley of Picket Fences and Chicago Hope, who just walked away from both of those shows. And from the 60s until his death last year, there's Dennis Potter, whose overall body of TV work is better and more original than anybody's. Surprisingly, there's more of Potter to come. Just before he died, Potter wrote 2 more dramas with music that will be presented jointly next year by England's Channel 4 and the BBC. They're called Karaoke and Cold Lazarus. I've read the scripts, and they're brilliant. Undoubtedly, PBS or some cable network will import them both, so we have those to look forward to. The rest of Potter's amazing output is another matter. The Singing Detective, his masterpiece to date, has never been released on video. And Pennies from Heaven, after a similarly low-key public TV showing, has been equally hard to find. Most of the rest of Potter's work has never been televised in this country at all, so the only way to see it is to travel to New York's Museum of Television and Radio. That's why I'm excited that Lipstick on Your Collar, which was televised in New York last year, has been released this month by New Video. It's not Potter's best work by any means, but even average Potter is more watchable and surprising than most of what else is out there. The setting this time is the 50s, and it's about the work and home lives of some clerks in Britain's War Office during the Suez Canal crisis. As always in these dramas with music, characters are apt to break into song, and lip-syncing any voice at just about any time. Imagine this. One of the War Office clerks is reading a newspaper account of Anthony Eden's speech about the crisis in the Suez. We hear the Prime Minister's voice, but then we suddenly cut to the House of Commons, where Eden's voice is replaced in mid-sentence by the head clerk. He's repeating Eden's speech before Parliament. But then his voice is replaced, too, as he begins lip-syncing an appropriate rock song from the period. Listen.
Her Majesty's government is ever mindful of the fact that this vital waterway is a main artery of world trade, and a fundamental interest in the defense and the business of this nation. Unilateral action by President Nasser puts in jeopardy not only the efficient and proper use
of an international waterway, but also the proper conduct of international relationships as we understand them. Time for the President of Egypt to pause for thought.
Hear, hear.
There are some things he just cannot do.
Yeah.
And so I say to Colonel Nasser, take heed. You may imagine that you can do what you will, but...
Well, it's 1 for the money, 2 for the show, 3 to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you... on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything for me, off of my blue suede shoes.
What else can I say? There's a sexy movie usher played by Louise Germain who is lusted after by 3 different men, one who's sexy, one who's timid, and one who's obsessed. There's enough profanity, sex, violence, and intrigue to make NYPD Blue look like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and enough originality to make you miss Dennis Potter all the more. The most compelling reason to seek out Lipstick on Your Collar, though, is as a sort of sneak preview. Germain, who stars, and Rennie Rye, who directs, have teamed with Singing Detective producer Kenneth Trodd for the upcoming Karaoke and Cold Lazarus, so this is a chance to catch some of their earlier work. Trust me, though, the best is yet to come.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. He reviewed Dennis Potter's Lipstick on Your Collar, released by New Video. Also just released is Without Walls, the last interview Potter gave to the BBC. The day after Thanksgiving is called Black Friday in the retail world. It's perhaps the busiest shopping day of the year. We asked Robin Becker to read her poem, Shopping, about some of the darker reasons we head to the stores. She teaches poetry writing at Pennsylvania State University.
Shopping.
If things don't work out, I'll buy the belt with the fashionable silver buckle we saw on Canyon Road. If we can't make peace, I'll order the leather duster and swagger across the plaza in Santa Fe, cross-dressing for the girls. If you leave, I'll go back for the Navajo blanket and the pawn ring. Bargain with the old woman who will know I intend to buy. If you pack your things, if you undress in the bathroom, if you see me for what I am, I'll invest in the folk art mirror with the leaping rabbits on either side. I'll spring for the Anastasi pot with the hole in the bottom, where the spirit of the potter is said to escape after her death. If you say you never intended to share your life, I'll haunt the museum shops and flea markets. I'll don the Spanish riding hat, the buckskin gloves with fringe at the wrists. I'll step into the cowboy boots, tanned crimson and designed to make any woman feel like she owns the street. If you never touch me again, I'll do what my mother did after she buried my sister. Outfitted herself in an elegant suit for the rest of her life.
Robin Becker has a forthcoming collection of poems called All American Girl, which will be published next March by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tuohy. Alan Tu directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting historic presidential speeches, a 6-CD collection of oratory from every 20th century president, produced in conjunction with the Library of Congress. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Temple Grandin. She's autistic and, in spite of that, has had a remarkable career designing humane restraining systems for cattle and hogs. Oliver Sacks profiled her in his book An Anthropologist on Mars. She tells her own story in her new book, Thinking in Pictures. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.